Hi, welcome to this week's program. On one of my most recent commentaries, I spoke about Howard Marks and shared some of his investing philosophies with you. Today, I want to share 12 key insights that are commonly shared by the top 99 investors in the world. But first, let me give you some background. Magnus Agenfeldt is a retired hedge fund manager and financial journalist from Sweden who recently wrote a book titled The World's 99 Greatest Investors, The Secret of Success, where he looks at the top 99 investors by highest absolute returns, irrespective of investment style. His lists include names you know and many you may not know, folks like John Bogle from Vanguard, of course Warren Buffett, Leon Cooperman, Ken Fisher, Mario Gabelli, Carl Icahn, Mark Mobius, and on, there's quite a few names here. Agenfeldt says, on average, his chosen 99 investors outperform the market by about 12 percentage points each year for 25 years. In the top 99, investing styles vary quite a bit, from value investing to speculating to quantitative-based trading. More than half of the top 99 are from the U.S., and of these, about half are value investors who buy good stocks when they're marked down. But his list does not include prominent investors such as bond king Bill Gross of PIMCO, and for a simple reason. As Agenfeldt puts it, neither Gross nor any other investor who solely focuses on bonds made the cut because their returns just are simply not high enough relative to the returns on equity investments. And the list has no women either, again, simply because no women made the cut purely on returns delivered over 25 years, even though the author names women investors such as Susan Byrne of Westwood Management, who has produced better returns than many men, but just not enough to qualify for the top 99. And one of my favorite investment websites, GuruFocus.com, compiled a list of Agenfeldt's top 12 insights that were common to almost all of the top 99. So here's the list. Number one, be true to yourself. As Guy Spier, a Harvard-trained investor, puts it, my job is to be Guy Spier. I'm not going to do a very good job being Bill Ackman or Warren Buffett, but I'm going to do a damn good job of being Guy Spier, better than anyone on the planet. Everybody's path is unique, and I think it's really, really important that we find our own path. Number two, know your strengths and weaknesses. And there's really no commentary to this except my own, which basically is that once you learn what your strengths are and your weaknesses are, you are in the home stretch of being a successful investor. And sticking with your strengths and keeping your weaknesses at bay and working to strengthen your weaknesses will help you immeasurably. Number three, consider the risks, not the potential. You see, this one goes back to Howard Marks' comment on playing not losers tennis, which is basically about focusing on the risks as much as on the rewards so you avoid loss-making investments. Number four, be prepared to change your strategy if the market changes. And this is a key insight. A lot of changes over a 25-year period. Just compare, for example, our world and lifestyle in 1989 as to where it is today. Much has changed, so these top 99 investors have been very adept at keeping their ears to the ground for seismic changes in the investing landscape and making moves ahead of others to deliver these outstanding returns without being stuck to rigid strategies, while also being core to their fundamental approach to investing. So, for example, Buffett was a value investor then and is a value investor now, but he has changed his strategy over the years, from small businesses to big businesses, from domestic only to international, from non-tech to selectively tech. So markets evolve and great investors evolve with them. One other thing that Buffett did is he would buy what they used to call old cigar butts, meaning companies that just had one puff left in them, pay an incredibly low price and liquidate it at a higher price and make money. And then he changed his investment strategy to reflect buying great companies at fair prices, a big change that led to tremendous success. All right, number six, don't let your emotions cloud your judgment. You know, this is the one every investor knows about, but still, most of us appear to be powerless against our own emotions. But I think you can train yourself to be an objective investor. And the best way to do so has more to do with research and knowing what you own and doing the due diligence necessary. If you get that right, chances are emotions will not cloud your judgment. You see, in life too, I think our emotions tend to rule where we are low on facts about the situations we face. And in such cases, we tend to gut react. But where you know your facts and the playing field well, emotions play a much smaller role in decision making and objectivity kicks in. So, link point number 6 to thorough investment research, and I think half your battle is also won. And by the way, what I do in really bad markets is I go back to the books, I start reading what the great investors have done, I get my head screwed back on straight, get my emotions under control so I can make clear-headed decisions. Number 7, don't invest in something you don't understand. This is Buffett through and through. A great example of that was that he famously sat out the dot-com boom. Number 8, be disciplined and work hard. Truly evaluating an investment from all angles is a lot of work. So discipline and hard work are always key pillars that hold up great investment portfolios. Number 9, only do business with reputable companies and guard your reputation. Reputation really is everything for an ethical business person or investor. For example, Warren Buffett has been invited into several perilous situations through his investing career simply because people knew he could be trusted under the worst of circumstances. And Buffett has profited handsomely from those plays without an iota of unethical behavior. Number 10, don't underestimate the efficiency of the market and don't overestimate its perfection. Value investors believe the market often misprices investments on the upside and on the downside. So savvy investors should also understand that it's foolhardy to take on the market because the market almost always has more staying power than you do. So even when you know you're right, the market could easily go against you far longer than you can tolerate. And especially if you trade on margin, you can be right, but by the time you're proved right, you may be insolvent. That's not a position you ever want to be in. Number 11, it's not wrong to make mistakes, but it's wrong to fail to learn from them. And finally, number 12, patience is a virtue in investing as in all else. Where you've done your due diligence correctly, it pays to wait and sit out the bad times, or sometimes add to your positions if the market moves against your stocks. But patience only makes sense if you've done your research thoroughly and are very sure your investment thesis is fundamentally sound. On the flip side, it's a fool's errand to buy a stock on hearsay and sit patiently while it tanks for good reason. In many cases, you're often better off cutting your losses than watching your position sink. So yes, patience is a virtue, but make sure you use it in context. You know, as Anthony Robbins once said, the secret to success in any field is to find what successful people do, think about it, and act on, and do the same. So hopefully, you'll incorporate some of these 12 points into your investing approach going forward so you can make the top 99 list 25 years from now. Are there any topics we're missing? Guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show? Questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, PomeranZ.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, PomeranZ.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. My next guest is Peter Dunn, also known as Pete the Planner, an award-winning comedian and personal finance expert. He's also a USA Today columnist and the author of 10 books, and he hosts a popular radio show, The Pete the Planner Show, and is a columnist for the Indy Star. Pete the Planner. Peter Dunn, welcome to the show, Pete.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Just tell me really quickly how you've found yourself in this field of giving personal financial advice.
I used to be a financial planner and investment advisor, and I noticed a trend in my clients that they needed more help with dealing with money and less help investing. So I was like, hey, I'm going to start teaching people how to deal with money effectively from a budgeting cash flow perspective. And it worked so well, I ended up selling my investment practice, and now I work closely with financial advisors to fix the behaviors of their clients.
You know, you wrote an open letter to parents, which attracted my attention, which is why I asked you to join me today. And the letter was to parents who financially support their adult children, and I found it intriguing and well thought out. And it's part of a two-part series. The first part of the series is from the parent's point of view, and the second part of the series is from the adult child's point of view. Take us through that a little bit.
Well, it certainly, it takes two to tango, and when there is a dependency issue between parents and adult children financially, both parties have culpability there. From a parent's perspective, we love our kids so much and we don't want to see them fail or suffer that we're willing to martyr and sacrifice our money when they're struggling. And my assertion in the column, Steve, is that you're martyring the wrong resource. Don't martyr your money, martyr your feelings. Let them fail. Let them figure out that in order for their resources and their bills to match up, they're going to have to fail. And it's no different than teaching your kid to ride a bike after taking off the training wheels for the first time. Mm-hmm. If you don't let go, they're not going to learn. But if you let go, guess what? They're going to bleed. And it's uncomfortable when your 4 or 5 year old's doing that. And it's uncomfortable when your 24 or 25 year old is struggling in this big, scary world, but you got to stay out of it.
The child's ability after all these years of enabling, you know, their ability to do proper budgeting and be resourceful may be limited. So do you just cut them off?
I like setting a timeline. I mean, if you've established the precedent of helping them when you shouldn't, coming home and saying, hey, Steve and Pete the planner said you're out. Mm-hmm. Probably don't want to do that. Yeah. You want to say, look, by September 30th, we are going to stop our financial support of you. But the reality is, and this is that's so hard, is that by a parent being in this situation, and no one's going to want to hear what I'm about to say, but in a parent being in this situation, in some way, the parent has failed. And so admitting that you're in this problem and admitting that you have to fix it is an admission of guilt.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about student loans a little bit, because there's a huge amount of overhang of debt burden from all these student loans, you know, which in a sense makes the student out to be the victim. But the question is, you know, who made these decisions early on that allowed this young person to take on such large amounts of debt and perhaps go into fields that you really both knew were not going to be very profitable, and yet you kind of allowed it?
Yeah, when I find a parent supporting their adult child who was a clarinet major, and that she followed her passion or he followed his passion, it's, well, the good news is they can play a lot of sad music on the clarinet because
yeah,
there's no jobs. And so as a parent, if you're trying to prepare your child for the world, passion is great.
Yeah.
But we have to prepare people to be contributing members of this society that we so revere. And unfortunately, passions and contributing members of society sometimes don't match up when, Steve, and this is the important element, when student loans are involved. When student loans are not involved, guess what? You've earned the right to do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're going to have to pay back that education, you better be able to pay it back.
Mm-hmm. So again, in this sense, it's not just the child, it's also the parent's culpability in this decision-making process. You know, this idea that the parent's brain turns to mush when it comes down to the question as to whether you can allow your child to feel that pain.
Yeah, I mean, in my column, my assertion is not the only evidence of this. You talk to any high school coach of any sport, any band director across America, and you ask them how often they hear from parents about a problem going on as opposed to students these days and how that shifted over the last two decades.
Mm-hmm.
Parents have started taking their kids' side and not authority figure side.
Yeah.
And this is a prime example of, if you get a degree and you do well, it's the school's fault that you can't earn money, not the kid that got a degree in something that can never earn a living. And right. So we expect an 18-year-old to make the most important financial decision of their life is kind of a stupid idea.
Yeah, it sure is. Let's take a look at this process from the adult child's point of life. What do you think the adult child should say to the parent? Or, you know, what side of this coin do you think the adult child should be on?
It gets especially difficult when the parents didn't have a hard conversation with the student about what they're studying. Like if the parent let them off the hook and let them get a terrible degree with a lot of debt, then it's super complex. But I think it's on the child to cut themselves off because, like I said, when you become a parent, you love your kids so much, you're going to dive on a grenade for them. So you, as the child, have got to say, look, you live your retirement. I don't want to be your problem. And the harsh reality of this, Steve, and you as a financial professional know this, parents are delusional. They think that because they support their adult children, that the adult child is somehow going to have the wherewithal and financial means to repay the favor when they're elderly. No, yeah. They're not. Mm-hmm. They don't have the skills, they don't have the independence, and they're not going to have the money because they've been enabled for so long. And so I think the kid is the one that can say, all right, I'm done. I mean, I don't want to glorify what I did, but at the age of 22, I moved out of my house the second I graduated from college because I refused to make my problems my parents' problems, you know, because they paid for my college.
I'm speaking with Pete the Planner. His name is Peter Dunn, and he's an award-winning comedian and a personal finance expert. In the article, you listed a story about a firefighter client of yours who was pleased to welcome his son to his engine company. You want to take us through that for a few minutes?
Yeah, for years, this guy had been talking about getting his son out of another line of work and into the firefighting business. And mm-hmm. So he finally did. But the problem was the kid had like $6,000 in credit card debt. And the dad was so excited. He's like, you know what, man? I'm going to help you wipe that out. This is great. A few months later, the son shows up with a brand new, huge, like $40,000 truck, and he took on a car payment. So basically, the father ended up paying off this credit card debt, mm-hmm. and the son turned around and more or less financed the truck with the dad's generosity. It fractured the relationship, and it got worse when the dad got sick and had no money. Mm-hmm. And it is a perfect example of why, in my opinion, the generations should not mingle financially. Steve, the ultimate question here to ask is, when you were your children's age, did your parents assist you? And the answer is no. In no circumstance. Mm-hmm. Yet we now have 1,000 reasons as to why that all of a sudden makes sense, but it never will.
Yeah. You know, you write in the article that on the children's side, you know, if you're being supported by your parents, every French fry, every beer, every sandwich you consume is not yours to consume. It's your mom's beer. It's your dad's French fry and your mom's sandwich. Every song you download, every movie you watch, every mile you drive belongs to your parents. Final words?
People didn't like hearing that. I'm not joking when I tell you I have received 4 death threats.
Oh.
Because of that column. It hit a nerve of the United States, and I'm glad we're still talking about it. But it's an ugly topic, Steve. You haven't heard the last of it because this problem's only going to get worse with sort of the entitlement we have.
Well, I think it's the elephant in the room for many parents, and it's absolutely important that this be talked about. My guest, Peter Dunn, known as Pete the Planner, and you can find him at petetheplanner.com, and you can hear this interview again. You can actually download it and send it to your kids or send it to your parents. Thanks, Pete.
Thanks, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, PomerantZ.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Well, midterms are right around the corner, and if you're hoping for a blue wave in November, you're going to want to know what you're rooting for. Rick Newman, senior columnist of Yahoo Finance, is back with me to discuss actually what a Democratic sweep could look like for your investments. Hey, Rick, welcome back.
Hey, Steve. Happy to be back.
You know, some put the odds as greater than 50-50 that Democrats will win control of the House of Representatives. the odds are not so high that they're going to take the Senate. First of all, where did the source of these odds come from?
Oh, there are a variety of sort of political forecasting operations. Larry Sabato is a professor at the University of Virginia. He runs something called the Crystal Ball. There's the Cook Political Report. These guys are deep in the weeds on what's happening in all the different House races. And they basically handicap every House race based on what polls and other data they have. And that's where we're getting to this idea that odds of the Democrats taking the House might be, I'd say, around 65% at this point.
Hmm. Well, I know there's a website called predictit.org. Have you seen that?
Yep.
So that's where you can actually bet on these things. And you have this kind of crowdsourcing type of betting that some say is more accurate than, I guess, whatever discounting economists may do or so on.
Yeah. And Predictit, and there are some other sites like that, they're not doing any original research into what's likely to happen in the election. They're just taking bets.
Yeah.
So Predictit basically reflects what the market, if you will, which is basically everybody who is weighing in on it with an opinion on this, what the market thinks is likely to happen.
Yeah. So it's like Vegas odds kind of thing.
Sort of. And I think last time I looked, you know, that's kind of predicted was kind of close to what these other research operations were saying.
I bet secretly those other research operations are just going to the website and getting all their information.
They could be.
Getting their odds and then kind of figuring out a story behind it. Only kidding. All right. So you wrote recently that if the Dems do win, it could be bad for investors. If Republicans lose control of the Congress, but not the Senate, I mean, wouldn't that be gridlock? Why is that so bad for investors?
Yeah. Well, so let me go through three possible scenarios here in the midterms. The first scenario is nothing changes and Republicans retain control of both houses of Congress. The second scenario is that Democrats take one house of Congress, but not both. And if that happens, it's almost certainly going to be the House of Representatives and not the Senate. And then the third scenario is that Democrats, there is a blue wave and the Democrats take control of both houses of Congress. So I think to the extent markets are pricing any of this in, I think markets expect what the polls are basically saying, that the likeliest outcome is that Democrats take the House, but not the Senate. So we have split Congress. And that is a gridlock scenario, which means stuff that Trump has already gotten done, that would mainly be the tax cuts, will stay in effect. There's no way Democrats would be able to undo that, but that Democrats would be able to block further Trump legislation or Republican legislation. So that basically, we would just have what we have right now for the next 2 years. The more interesting scenario is if Democrats take both houses, which would be a big surprise because it's very difficult for them to take control of the Senate just because of the way the elections are set up this year. And I think if Democrats did take control of the Senate, markets would interpret that as a surprising shift to the left among voters. Mm-hmm. So that would be voters saying, you know what, it's not just that we want Republicans out. We're actually moving considerably further to the left than anybody anticipated. And a Democrat-controlled Congress would still not be able to override a Trump veto. So not much would really change before 2020. But that would tell us that the odds of a Democrat getting elected in the 2020 presidential election are probably greater than people think right now. And if we were to have a Democratic president take office in 2021, that could threaten elements of the Trump agenda, especially the tax cuts and some of his deregulatory efforts. So that's what would really interest markets. And I think we would see a market reaction in that instance.
Right. So both parties seem to have moved away from the center. It seems like the Republican Party has definitely gone right. The voices that come out of the Democratic Party seem to be moving way to the left. I don't hear the middle being represented. I'm not saying it's not. I just don't seem to hear it. So even if let's say the Democrats took control of the House, and let's say they took control of the House commandingly, but they didn't take control of the Senate. So that's gridlock. You know, if the Dems were able to get some bills passed, I mean, Trump has veto power. But do you think, and maybe at what point, do you think that the investors will start looking ahead to the 2020 election?
Investors, we'll put it this way, the candidates will be looking ahead to the 2020 election, the day that the 2018 election is over.
Yeah.
But markets have a lot to digest between Election Day 2018 and Election Day 2020. So I think they'll be trying to figure out what kind of policy changes are we likely to affect. And remember, Trump is implementing a lot of protectionist trade policies with no input from Congress at all because he can. He doesn't need congressional input to do that for the most part. So I think investors will have their hands full just figuring out what comes next. And markets just don't care very much about what might happen in 2 years from now. I mean, just not that much forward thinking in the markets. Yeah. But one other thing I would like to toss in here is implications for the Robert Mueller investigation. This is just me speculating, but if you're Trump, you might be thinking, well, if Republicans win both houses of Congress, and I really do want to fire Robert Mueller, then that might be the scenario under which he does it. Mm-hmm. If Democrats have control of one house and therefore have control of the committees and newfound subpoena power and investigatory power, I think it makes it much harder for Trump to fire Robert Mueller because the blowback would be that much more severe in whatever house Congress demonstrated. Now, I'm not sure how much the Mueller investigation really does impact markets, but if it rises to the level of, you know, the possibility of impeachment, I think markets do care about that.
Yeah. We're talking about the midterm elections and what they might mean for investors, depending on what party takes over which house. I'm speaking with Rick Newman, senior columnist of Yahoo Finance. Let's review a little bit and discuss what the Republicans have already done to juice this economy. Of course, we all know about the tax cuts. What else?
There's been an increase in government spending last year. A lot of that was on defense, but there was an increase in spending on other things as well. Not something we typically associate with Republicans, but that is something they supported. And that is affecting GDP growth. I mean, that's one of the reasons we're seeing these strong GDP growth numbers for at least a couple of quarters. And that's kind of about it in terms of markets. We know there are other things Republicans have talked about doing, including another tax cut, even lower taxes.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like they are likely to get that done this year. But, you know, this is another issue that's on the table. If Republicans retain control of both houses of Congress, I think we will see additional tax cuts in 2019, which Trump would sign.
I think there's been a slashing of regulations as well.
Well, that's something that has happened more at an administrative level that Trump has been able to do himself. It's hard to, I mean, Trump has certainly talked about that, and we have seen a few high profile instances where, for example, he's making it easier for coal plants to operate, a lot of action on environmental regulations. It's very hard to quantify whether that is actually helping businesses in a tangible way right now. I mean, it's just, you know, the pass through, you know, some businesses say, yes, this is helping us, but it's hard to identify the pass through and whether this is actually helping create jobs or anything like that. But yeah, anecdotally, I think you can say, yes, he has cut regulations.
Well, I think it's important that you make that distinction, that you're not really seeing kind of the proof of this, but there is this general talk out there that not only do they reduce taxes, but they're also cutting regulations. But you're saying that it's not necessarily true, or it's in a way, he's done it in some areas which have gotten some press. But as far as systemically changing that, and you don't really see it. Let's talk about the Democratic platform. If they had control and they're moving into 2020 with the possibility of a Democratic president, what would their platform look like?
Democrats have been very clear that they would like to roll back some of the Trump tax cuts. If it were to happen, which it won't, as long as there's a Republican in the White House, but let's go, you know, if this were to happen in, say, 2021,
yeah.
I mean, this would directly affect markets. So Trump cut the corporate rate from 35% to 21%. There's Democratic legislation to push that back up to 25%. So it'd still be considerably lower than it used to be.
What was it before?
It was 35% before.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it would go up a little bit. And then they would undo the tax cuts in the higher tax brackets. And they want to use that money maybe for infrastructure spending, which, by the way, is something Trump favors, just not by rescinding his tax cuts or some other benefit programs. Democrats are also making healthcare one of their top issues this year, and you've seen more people signing on to the old Bernie Sanders idea of Medicare for all. That is an enormously complicated plan that would massively disrupt the U.S. healthcare system. And even if Democrats had full control of the government, I think that would be extremely hard to do. But it gets traction with voters because healthcare is a big problem in this country.
Yeah.
Too many people are paying way too much for their healthcare, or they can't even afford to pay for it at all. So Democrats are finding they're getting some traction on this.
Well, any increase in corporate taxes, I think, would affect the stock market because the market has risen on the fact, at least one important fact, that companies now have more cash in hand. They've been able to raise dividends. They've been able to buy back their own stock. This is very positive for the stock market. And to the degree that they're spending it on, you know, on an infrastructure or buying other companies and so on, I think that takes time to play out. But the bottom line really is that I think the market would also react to this idea that things are going to get a little tighter, a little liquidity is going to be reduced, with maybe even the fact of higher interest rates. We haven't really talked about that, but we are out of time. My guest, Rick Newman, senior columnist for Yahoo Finance. Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Good discussion.
And remember to visit our website, stevepomerantz.com, to join this conversation. You can listen or read all of our segments and sign up for our weekly update for important topics that we've all covered right on this show going back a long time, straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So we were talking about this off air, and we have a little bit of a disagreement here. So here's the question, or here's the point. Some homebuyers express concern that photos of their properties continue to live on real estate websites after they've closed on the purchase, and they're asking real estate professionals to help take them down, citing privacy and security issues. Someone named Deborah in Chicago wrote about this, and they're formally asking realtors to take off the photos.
Yeah, we get that from time to time. We'll get a phone call and they ask us to take down the photos, and we can. We take them out of the MLS system, which feeds to these third-party sites, and they can be removed. I get the concern, but as a professional real estate agent, we really enjoy the photos. Not that we want to look at your furniture and your decorating. We're really looking for, was that kitchen really updated? Because there's a lot of embellishing that goes on with agents when they sometimes write their descriptions. So,
is that true?
No.
I'm shocked. It's shocking.
You know, they exaggerate how beautiful the kitchen might be how updated. Okay, updated is a very general term. We're talking 2018 update or 2001 update.
Mm-hmm.
So update, not all updates equal.
All right, so the pictures are good for that type of thing.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So I would argue, please keep the pictures because it's helpful. And the way that I look at it, if you take your photos down and I'm going to sell the house next door, and I don't know what your house looked like, and now I sell the neighbor's house for less, well, you're going to be mad, Mr. Buyer who just bought that house. I sold it for less because I didn't know what your house looked like, and I had just assumed it wasn't as nice.
Mm-hmm.
So I said,
I don't necessarily, I don't totally buy that. But I think the bottom line is that once you've closed on the house, and then you're kind of scouting around, and you go and you see your house again, it's still up on the web. It's like, I don't like the way that feels. Okay. So I feel like it's kind of an invasion of privacy. I mean, I get your point.
Okay. Did you go back and look at your photos and do kumbaya and everything when you sold your home just to take a look?
No, but Deborah from Chicago did and she didn't like it. All right. Let's move on here. So last week we were talking about how home prices nationwide were up over 6%.
Yes.
And that means that people have more equity in their homes,
which is
a wonderful thing because that was something that we've been lacking for all these years after the 2005 crisis. So now people are flush again.
Yep.
And experts like myself are warning that don't use it as a piggy bank.
Absolutely.
This is not a piggy bank. This is for, your use if you're going to move into the future, maybe take some money off the table in retirement if you want to get to your equity a little bit, or for emergencies.
Right. I agree wholeheartedly. We saw during the bad years, people buying boats and luxury goods and so on and so forth. And that aided in the crash of the market.
Exactly.
Now, it's okay to buy and to renovate your kitchen, put money back into the house. I think that's probably a healthy and good thing. As long as you know that you're going to, I believe the guidelines should be, have it paid off in 5 years.
Hey, look. Yeah. Well, if you have the discipline to do that, that's
fine.
If
you do.
Yeah.
That would be what I would tell you to do.
But here's the thing. We come across many people who really haven't saved enough.
Right.
And their equity in their home is really their only asset, their real asset. And the assets can be fairly significant.
That's right.
And then as they age, they have to, let's say, go into an assisted living facility or they need some special care. They really don't have the assets to pay for that except for their home.
That's right.
And it makes total sense at that point in your life to sell your home, take that equity and use it to live the rest of your life in comfort. if you're spending all of that equity as the years progress, you really end up with nothing.
That's right.
And that, I think, is the true use, because people tend to live in their houses a long time. So you're really going to need it at the end. It's almost like a bank account. For
and
that.
At the very end, a reverse mortgage isn't necessarily a bad thing.
No.
Yeah. So you have to have equity to have a reverse mortgage. That's and right. You have to have at least 80%, I believe.
Well, you're tapping the equity out of your home. You can do it through line of credit.
Right.
A home equity line of credit, or you can do it through a reverse mortgage. Reverse mortgages aren't perfect, but in the right situation, they can really be lifesavers, in my opinion.
Yep, I agree.
Okay. All right. Here's a question that was raised. If neighbors share a wall, who fixes mutual problems? Here's the question. I live in a townhome in a homeowners association where there are 4 units attached on each parcel by an archway. I have bees in the wall of the archway that need to be removed. My neighbor says that the association is responsible because the problem is not within the 4 walls of our units. Mm. The association says it's my responsibility. Who is correct?
Well, there's no one answer. You need to absolutely look at the documents and see. And don't necessarily take the word of the association, because half the times they don't even read their own documents.
Well, first of all, your neighbor you respect your neighbor's opinion, but it may not be an expert
opinion.
That's
right. That's right. So really, the answer is in the documents. And if the documents don't cover this, it would fall under common law. And under common law, then it would revert for you to handle it between the two of you and not the association.
Okay. You were bringing up an issue if people shared a roof.
Right.
And I mean, having bees in the wall, one thing, but it would be more common if there were roof problems and roofs had to be replaced.
That's right. And you see it all the time. So what happens is you've got 4 units, 1 roof, but they're a little subdivided a little bit. And you're in the middle. You need to replace your roof because it's leaking. You ask the neighbor to go ahead and change their roof. They don't have the money to do it, et cetera, et cetera. So you go ahead and change your little 1/4 of the roof. Mm-hmm. Now you have this beautiful, shiny white roof and everyone else is, you know, gray and dingy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look good. So if you're buying a property like a townhome with attached properties, just know what you're getting into. Find out. A lot of times it's covered by the association. So all the roofs are changed at once.
Well, the association would have an interest in keeping everything conforming.
Yeah, but there are a lot of neighborhoods out there that I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
It's not done that way.
Yeah.
Just know what you're getting into.
Okay. I mean, I have seen these situations where, you know, there's different color roofs on attached townhouses.
Right.
Right. And you know that that's not the intention, but I think they ran into the situation you just mentioned.
That's right.
All right. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. And she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. I want to introduce to you a most interesting fellow. He helped build the operating system for the iPod and became part of the Skunkworks team charged with creating the iPhone. Andy Grignon is with me to discuss this experience as well as fill us in about National Geographic's latest documentary, The 2000s, A New Reality. Hi, Andy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, you know, the 2000s weren't that long ago, yet changes in that decade changed the world undeniably. Every time you go through the TSA at the airport or answer a call on your smartphone, you're impacted by those events. Where does National Geographic actually begin its documentary? Where's ground zero for the 2000s?
Well, when you think about it, you know, you actually kind of brought it up, right? 9/11 was a very transformative event, and it kind of set the tone in a way for the decade, right? We had a lot of things that happened, but in terms of impact, you know, I just flew out to New York recently, and I've got pre-check, you know, that TSA special get through the line quickly kind of a thing. And that's the way flying used to be way back when. And we've just kind of taken for granted the fact that, you know, we have to take our shoes off and our belts and all this other thing. And that's just life now, right?
Yeah.
Unless you actually have, you know, this special program or whatever to get you through all that. But we start to look at, I think, the impact, not only security, but technology and just some of the events when you look back at the decade. So there's some fun things, right? Like Survivor. We started to usher in that, you know, reality TV kind of era, which was again, it's just part of the fabric of of life today.
Right. Looking back at the TSA, you look at old movies and you see them smoking and just getting on the plane on the last minute.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that those are days incredibly gone by. You know, we've skipped to the 9/11 era, of course, but, you know, back in the 2000s, when there was the Bush-Gore campaign, the hanging chads, and in the notes that you guys provided us, there seemed to be a link between the Elian Gonzalez episode and the Bush-Gore campaign. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I think those were all things that I had just, as far as I was, you know, kind of raised, you know, 2000, gosh, what am I, I'm 42 now. So, you know, that was, you know, I was still kind of, you know, just spreading my wings, learning about, you know, current events, and I was a late bloomer in that respect. But I remember, again, I go back to 9/11 as like the thing where I started to really pay attention to current events.
Right.
As a tech nerd, all I did was focused on writing software. And I ignored pretty much everything else. But I remember that moment, you know, waking up and seeing the towers collapse. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah,
that's where I started to kind of tune in to life. And so that for me was kind of a big event.
Mm-hmm.
And the other events that kind of happened, you know, those are all big things. But the hanging chad thing, I remember hearing about it, but I wasn't actively participating in life at that moment.
Right.
You know what I mean? Especially in tech nerddom, we have this ability to put the blinders on. Yeah, I've got guys that used to work for me that didn't know what day it was. They just kind of show up every day. And and I've been there, done that. But it's kind of funny to see a show like this, which kind of recaps. You're like, oh, I kind of remember that, right?
Yeah.
You start to see how, you know, all these events that happened. And, you know, and again, watching the show, I was like, oh, yeah, I remember Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction.
Yeah.
I remember all those kind of funny things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, it wasn't front and center.
Talking about being a nerd, I mean, you were involved with the iPod and the iPad, and you worked with Steve Jobs. So, I mean, if you talk about something that really did change the way we live, you know, not too long ago, I saw an old photo of an ad from Radio Shack, and it was, I guess, in the 70s, and it listed all of the things that they sell at the store, which was a big fat phone, a clock, a calculator, and on and on and on. And then you think about it, well, that's all available in your iPhone today. Tell us about that experience of developing the iPod and the iPad and working with Steve Jobs. Tell us the good, bad, and the ugly.
Well, you know, it was interesting. When the iPod, I think, was the very first product that became an extension, you know, of ourselves, right? It was our ability to express, you know, that creative side. You could hold at the time 1,000 songs in your pocket, right? Like, that was the tagline. And that was kind of, it wasn't mind-blowing, but it was like, oh, wow. Like, I get to keep my music, which is kind of neat. And then when we kind of iterated, we built the first phone. By the way, the very first phone that we did was pretty much what everyone was expecting at the time. We took a phone and we bolted it onto an iPod. And so the same click wheel, you know, circular interface, the symbols would change when you put it into phone mode, into like this big 0-9 rotary, you know, dial kind of a thing. So you text it that way, you dial that way.
Yeah.
And it was as miserable to use as it sounds. but that's our first attempt, right? Like, we're just like, oh, let's make this thing. And then at some point, somebody had this idea to marry this touch technology that we had. to a new class of device? What if we were to make the phone have touch? And that's really what set the wheels in motion.
Now, you guys had an opportunity to hire people from Palm and people from Nokia, but Steve Jobs said no,
oh,
right?
Yeah. Well, it was actually very smart. So back in the day when we first started developing, I carried around a Palm Trio 650, which was like the baller's phone way back when, right? Uh-huh. It had like this tiny little screen and the full keypad, but that's what all the business execs and everybody who is anything had like this phone.
Yeah.
And we carried it because that's the reminder of the product we didn't want to end up with. We didn't quite know what we were shooting. We had some designs, we had some hardware and software designs, but we wanted to set out to create a whole different class of product. And so Steve had made an edict, which was, you know, thou shalt not hire people from the phone business. And the thinking, I think, that he was trying to do was like, when you're trying to build a phone, you're like, of course, the fastest way for us to build the phone is to hire people who know how to build phones.
Yeah.
Because we know nothing about it. But his thinking was, while I care about the schedule, I don't want to end up with another Me Too product. I don't want to end up with a Trio 650.
Mm-hmm.
I want to end up with a new kind of thing. And if we got to, you know, really work hard at figuring out how to do that, then we have to do that. So we ended up flipping the schedule, I think, by about a year to figure out how to actually make a phone. I was the guy that pitched visual voicemail to AT&T.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to ask you. What was AT&T's response when you did that? First of all, what is visual voicemail anyway?
So back in the day, or you could voicemail, right? And you'd have to hit like 4 to rewind, 7 to delete, or
whatever it was.
You just had this cryptic set of numbers you'd hit.
Yeah.
And now, you know, visual voicemail, again, to a computer person, it's just another version of email, right? You got a subject, you got an attachment, which is a message. And, and so that was, you know, kind of the thinking that we had. When I went to go pitch it, you know, the response was, how about not enthusiastic? it was funny because, you know, I get up there and it was like this awful wedding, right? It was like half of the room is AT&T, half of the room is Apple. And you get up there and you're like, all right, here's this crazy idea, right? And basically, I got a pat on the head, which was, you don't quite understand how complicated voicemail systems are, right? There's the sphincter valve connected to the McNewton nut, and it's got this, and 4 people in Iowa need to do that. And it's just like they trail out all these reasons why it can't be done.
Yeah.
And you go back to why Steve didn't want us to hire phone people. Because if I would have hired a phone person from Palm or wherever onto my team, and we were just brainstorming the idea of visual voicemail, now we have somebody kind of internally, which would be shooting it down before we even got a chance to be naive and pitch to AT&T.
Right.
You know, our own person would be like, oh, you know, the sphincter valve, the Newton nut, 4 people in Iowa. And we would have, you know, shot the idea down before we had the chance to really pitch it.
Yeah, that was the difference operating at Apple at that time with under Steve Jobs. I'm not making any commentary about what's going on today because I have no idea. But back then, I mean, you had this driving force who had quite a reputation, both positive and negative, but nevertheless, just this driving force to be completely new and completely innovative. Do you think any other company could have developed the iPhone?
Absolutely not. We even had a hard time building it. And we had, and Apple still does have, a really deep bench. You know, they've got some of the smartest people in the industry, and they have the clout so that when things go wrong, you know, we had one instance where it was really going bad. And we had to bring in the people that wrote the software to make the chips so that we could get everybody into a room so we could figure out this one particular problem. And no other company that I know of could have pulled off something like that. Yeah.
Didn't Apple spend like $150 million developing it? Did I read that somewhere? Was that the
number? I actually don't know. I have no idea how much we spent on it.
Okay.
But we crafted everything. We built our own radio chambers, you know, the antennas that were all custom designed. Everything was custom designed. Yeah. Because when you think about it, there was nothing about the iPhone, the very first iPhone, that should have made it work in the first place. Right? We were starting with a brand new piece of hardware that we'd never built.
Yeah.
With chips that didn't exist. We had Samsung make us a chip. And other people, we got everything was custom. And then we put an operating system on it that didn't ever exist. So it's a brand new version of Mac OS, which is used to running in gigabytes of RAM, and now all of a sudden we get a tiny little bit of memory.
And I'm speaking with Andy Grignon, former developer of the iPod and the iPhone. You know, Andy, you and I have been talking about the development of the iPhone and the iPod and how it transformed things. But another element which was created during that period of time, which has really just exploded and I think transformed the world even to a greater degree, is social media. Were you involved with social media at the very beginning?
You know, it's funny because when we first created the phone, we didn't want to allow anybody to write software for it, right? It was supposed to be this little closed box that made phone calls and used the software that we originally put on it, right? And now you kind of fast forward to where we are today. And I don't know about you, but I actually don't use my phone as a phone, really. I'll be standing in line at a grocery store, you know, tweeting about, you know, whatever the person in front of me is doing, you know, whatever random thing, right?
Yeah.
And now I think a lot of us use our phones for everything but. And that goes both ways. So it's kind of good to, like, you know, something, you know, crazy happens, right? There's an earthquake and you want to tell people you're okay. Or, you know, those are I think, fairly positive impacts on social media. You know, being able to sit there while you're thinking of it, like, oh, wouldn't it be great to just have some more Q-tips right now, or whatever it is. And so you call up your phone and just Amazon order it, one click, bam, there it is. You know, it'll show up in a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are kind of some positive ones. The negative ones, you know, you're at a bar at 2 in the morning and what seems like an awesome post to make on Facebook certainly doesn't seem like an awesome post the next morning. Right?
So it follows you around. But the beautiful thing about Facebook and Twitter is that really it's just so ephemeral that it may seem important at the time, but really, you know, 2 minutes later, it's gone or forgotten because it's been replaced by 1,000 other people's thoughts.
Absolutely. But, you know, at least the way I use social media is, you know, it allows me to stay connected with people that even though they're small moments and even though it's flooded with 1,000 other people's, you know, thoughts, it allows me to stay connected to people that I normally wouldn't really stay connected with, right? Like even just my family, like my mom, right? Every now and then I see her post something. It's like, oh, hey, that's happening.
Yeah.
Right? And I haven't talked to her in a couple of weeks, but it's kind of nice to know that little bit, you know, in that moment of her life.
Right.
Now, you distill that down to like a tweet, and, you know, again, the guy in front of me is ordering apples or whatever. And you're just like, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Right? Like, that's just noise.
Yeah. And really, but how many cats, cute pictures of cats and dogs? I mean, can we stand? I can't stand it anymore. You know?
Exactly. A couple years ago, I was with my family. We're doing Mother's Day brunch, right? And my wife's on her phone. My son's on his tablet, my daughter's on her phone, and I'm on my phone. And I just kind of look back, I'm like, wow.
That's terrible. Yeah, I mean,
like,
that's,
what happened? We're all furiously avoiding each other.
That's right. Well, you know, you go to a restaurant, you see a family there, there's a couple of young kids and two parents. The parents are talking and interacting, and the two kids are involved in their phones and whatever they're doing, playing a game or whatever. And it just seems to be something lost in that.
It is. And, you know, that was never the intent. You know, when we created these things, it was supposed to be a tool that allowed you to, you know, have a more connected life with like a browser so you can get directions or whatever. Like, you know, you come up with use cases, but then you open it up to everybody and then people start to do crazy stuff, right? Now you've got, you know, lunch being delivered in an hour anywhere you are. It's like all these crazy things that are now possible that weren't ever part of the plan.
You know, there is an old story when Xerox created the copier way, way back when. That they showed it to, I think it was Arthur Anderson, a consulting company, and the consulting company said, well, no, nobody's going to really buy this because really, you know, what is a big company? They're going to have like one or two copiers. They never could envision the use of a copier. And I think you're telling the same story in as much as you had these ideas for what the use would be, but you had no idea, nobody could, as to how the human nature and the human experience would change things.
Right. No, exactly. Again, this has played out on the desktop side as well. I remember when we were doing Mac OS, you know, computers. You'd put a new thing out, and then you'd wait to see what crazy thing some developer would build on it. And it's neat to see people just, you know, when you have a global audience, you start to see people are taking and solving problems that are important to them in whatever, wherever they are.
Yeah.
You know, you start to see crazy things. You know, India is doing some really interesting stuff, but they're using technology to solve problems that are applicable to India.
Sure.
And I think that's actually one of the things that Silicon Valley, you know, that's as I'm a resident, I think we tend to solve problems that are appropriate for Silicon Valley and not necessarily what's appropriate for Iowa, you know, or Chicago.
When
as long as you're on either coast, you're good.
When did Apple decide to open up the software or the platform to allow others to write and create applications? Was that a separate decision?
It was a separate decision, although there was this idea that going back to we didn't want developers to crash the phone, we thought, oh, we can get away with making a sandbox, you know, for them. So we can do it inside of the web browser.
Okay.
So we had these web apps.
Mm-hmm.
And the developers, you know, started to do some of those apps, but they started complaining loudly that they didn't have enough access to do the things they really wanted. And then it became a scramble. And so this was, I think, around the second iteration of the product where I was out of Apple at that point, where they allowed developers to get right down to the metal and build whatever they wanted. And now you started to see games. Like, that was the very first, you know, kind of adoption like make all these crazy games.
I guess as long as Apple could figure out how to monetize it, it didn't really matter, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, because that's first and foremost.
Well, and that's one of the things, I mean, they trot that statistic out pretty much every time that they get in front of people.
Mm-hmm.
The number of app downloads they've had,
yeah.
You know, billion dollars paid out or whatever it is to developers or, you know, how many billions of downloads, you know, that have happened on the App Store.
Yeah,
and really what they're basically saying is, yeah, look how much money we've made. Well, and now we're having the inverse problem. So it's kind of like the gold rush in the early days where you'd have these apps created. And then it got to the point where everybody's making an app.
Yeah.
And now you've got a discoverability problem. How do you promote the thing you've got versus the other thing? And now once we have people downloading, you know, on your screen, you've got pages and pages of apps. And now it's not only is it discoverability to get people to download it, but then it's a retention issue. Why is somebody going to use your app every day?
Yeah.
There's this idea where whatever's on the front page is the apps that people pretty much exclusively use.
Yeah.
And if you're on the second or third page, you get launched whenever
it's like bored. It's like a Google thing too. I mean, if you're not on the first page in a Google search, you know, I think the odds go down tremendously.
Absolutely. But, you know, but what's interesting is the fact that we're even having this conversation, right? 10 years ago, it's like when we were in the 2000s, people didn't know what memory was, right? Google, a search engine, was starting to be picked up, right? But largely people didn't really need to think that they could just search for whatever they wanted out of, you know, billions of pages of content.
Mm-hmm.
And now the fact that I can talk to my mom about things like Google, voice recognition, posting to YouTube, that is just wasn't, first it didn't exist way back when, but the fact that it's part of the vocabulary today I think is kind of a profound thing. And that topics that, again, my mom's generation would just throw their hands up and I don't know how to program the VCR. I don't know how to do this. Like, it's funny, you know, but way back when, like, that's what you just did.
Yeah.
And now they're grasping concepts which are infinitely more complicated than programming a VCR.
My guest is Andy Grignon. He helped develop the iPod and the iPhone. And today we were talking about National Geographic's terrific series chronicling the dynamic changes in America and for those 10 tumultuous years. Andy, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experience about Apple. We all really want to know that stuff, you know?
Happy to. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowicz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.